Welcome to Byzantium and Friends, a podcast where we discuss a lot of the more interesting work that's taking place in the field of Byzantine studies these days. Before my introduction today, I would like to take us back to 1959, when Irving Goffman published a very influential and sort of short and readable book called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. And this is a book that today we would classify as operating at the intersection between sociology, psychology, and even anthropology. The book is about how human behavior in Western societies, but presumably the thesis can be extrapolated to other kinds of societies, takes place according to specific scripts. So overtly adopting a kind of theatrical metaphor, dramatological, for how social interaction takes place. We have ideas about what's expected of us in a certain context, and we put on a persona that reflects that script and that attempts to play that script well in order for us to reap the benefits that we want to get from that encounter. So overall, it's a quite fascinating exploration of the different personas and the different scripts that we are regularly performing. Now, what we don't find in Goffman's analysis is any sense of what the self is apart from those personas. So what's behind the mask? Is there anything behind the mask? And it's not clear from his analysis that there is any there. In other words, the human being is sort of dissolved and disintegrated into a series of performances. That's sort of all there is, at least really in the book. To that degree, it's a kind of analysis that pushes against the notion of, quote, identity that really wasn't part of the theoretical picture when this book was written. That kind of came in later. But insofar as we think of identity as having some kind of stability or, you know, definite traits that exist and persist over time, this is very deconstructive of that, right? And so theorists who are against identity will often take this kind of approach, which is that there's no thing there. It's just a series of, sort of incommensurate, discontinuous moments of performances that at least that's the only thing that we can access. And I'm speaking here more of historians, not psychologists. When historians take a critical approach to identity, it's often to present it human beings as so fluid in their social encounters and so changeable that we can't point to one moment and say, this is it, rather than that. So that more critical view has a distinguished philosophical pedigree. I'm aware, for example, of the 18th century philosopher David Hume, who was one of the more successful sort of skeptical philosophers in a whole bunch of matters. But his view of a person was deconstructive in this way, that he said that a person is nothing but a bundle or collection of different perceptions which succeed each other with an inconceivable rapidity and are in a perpetual flux and movement. Right. So if you apply that kind of approach to anything, it begins to sort of disintegrate in front of your eyes and becomes less of a thing. I have seen that kind of approach brought to whole societies and states, and you name it. You can do that with anything. Ultimately, it traces its philosophical pedigree back to Heraclitus, the idea that you can never enter the same river twice, to which actually a later Greek philosopher responded, twice, you can't even enter it once. So coming to our topic, there was no person in the Eastern Roman Empire whose social position and persona was more fixed by scripts that he had to perform than the emperor. And the most important part of that performance and the script was the emperor's clothing, garments, dress, call it what you will. Because emperors were, in those moments when they were performing their role in a whole range of contexts. They had to put on different kinds of performances. We'll be talking about some of those in our discussion. They were normally not expected to do much talking or much movement, at least not compared to the people around them. And so a greater burden on communication was placed on what they were wearing and the context in which they were wearing it. So in many ceremonial, performative, scripted contexts, the emperor essentially was communicating what his clothes were communicating. Now, we will note two things here that push back against the more deconstructive approach. The first is that imperial clothing and self-presentation were part of a tradition that was very conservative. It did change, but it over the course of a millennium, it didn't change that much, and not rapidly at any one time. So the changes would have been gradual. So there is a considerable amount of continuity in the scripts and personas that emperors were performing at any one time. In other words, the model of sort of infinitely or potentially infinite flux is just not applicable to this script. I personally don't think it's applicable to most scripts that human beings perform in social contexts. I don't think human beings are that malleable or flexible. They are to a certain degree, but not infinitely so, as the more deconstructive scholarship sometimes assumes. The second thing I will notice is that we get the ceremonial or scripted version of emperors, primarily in images of emperors, such as manuscript illuminations, also in panegyrics sometimes. But then there's this other body of evidence, what we rely on primarily to reconstruct history, which are historical sources. And in the historical sources, those scripted personas are largely absent. East Roman historians discuss the emperors as personalities who are very different from each other, and they have virtues and vices, and they behave in this way and that way. And the scripts and the ceremonial context are largely absent from those works. In other words, many contemporaries and observers, and I would argue all of them, were perfectly capable of distinguishing between the person and the script. Right? And historians tended to focus on the person and actions and policies and speech, right? Whereas the ceremonial aspects tended to elevate the person into an office and, or in a way, reduce him to a script. But in order for us to even have this discussion, to be able to put the historical kind of moving sources into dialogue with the ceremonial or kind of like more static hieratic picture, we need to understand the latter, and we need to understand imperial dress because it was one of the most important aspects of imperial self-presentation, as I mentioned. It is very difficult to understand imperial dress in many ways because the images that we have are sort of very partial and they're keyed to specific occasions, but we need to be able to read, you know, what are those occasions and what was the script for them. And this is where the work of my guest today is crucial. Maria Parani is a professor at the University of Cyprus, and she has worked for decades on a number of interconnected topics that have to do with, I mean, very broadly speaking, the representation of aspects of daily life and of clothing and of material culture in visual media, especially art, but any visual media. Now, her work is very wide-ranging and it accomplishes many goals. I'm going to mention two of them here that are most relevant. The first is that if you're interested as a historian in just understanding the material realities of this world, sort of trying to get beyond the scripts of performance and representation that you see in the visual media and trying to understand, you know, just exactly what people were wearing or what implements were they using when they were eating and so forth, her work is fundamental. So, for example, if you are a historical novelist and you need to understand these questions, you absolutely have to engage with her work. But in addition, Maria brings an extraordinary sophistication when it comes to teasing out the cultural nuances of these representations and also of the material culture itself. That nuance, for example, might entail situating a particular garment within its overall cultural context, sort of what did it signify in sort of the network of values in which it was placed, or when we have to do with cultural context. So for example, between Latins and Greeks or East Romans in any particular context, sort of what are the semiotics of wearing this item or that item in a particular context of encounter and exchange. I mention these as only some of the topics of analysis that she takes on through her study of material culture and clothing in particular. And it took me a while to kind of define a topic that we could have a conversation around that didn't involve too much visual evidence because it's difficult to present in the audio medium. And I think that the imperial clothing is precisely such a topic. Everyone, I think, has an image of what an emperor looked like in some of these manuscript illuminations, for example. But what I also thought was fascinating was exploring how and to what degree the court in Constantinople was a formal place. Like, I've still, after decades of reading these sources, I still don't have a kind of handle on whether it was a place where you could be spontaneous and make jokes and, you know, just exactly how scripted people were, or was it very formal and kind of any misstep in the nuance of your speech or comportment would, you know, cause embarrassment and scandal? I'm still torn about this. So it was fascinating to talk with her about some of these issues too. All right, so here's my conversation with Maria, and thanks also to medievalists.net for reposting these episodes. Maria, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I have been reading your work for very many years, and I've been looking for an opportunity to invite you onto the podcast. And the reason I've delayed is because you work at the intersection of sort of visual culture and sort of, you know, general cultural interpretation and cultural studies, but it's very difficult in the podcast medium to present all of the visual material that you use. Mm-hmm. However, a certain critical mass of scholarship, you know, came out of you in imperial clothing, and I thought that would be just a fabulous topic because mm-hmm. I think most of our audience has a kind of picture of what a Byzantine emperor looked like, especially for miniatures and manuscripts and so forth. And so we don't need to present like a really sort of rich visual evidence in order to explain what we're talking about. But obviously they can turn to your work and should to find all of the images that you provide there. So let's just start with some basic background here, because when emperors appeared in public, they often wore this distinctive garments. They're seen by very many people, often from a distance. So the garments themselves are sometimes the most important kind of visual presentation, right, of the emperor in public. Can you tell us what kinds of different functions those garments performed in public, even when the emperor wasn't actually doing anything? So what messages did they convey?
Well, first of all, they made him visible and distinctive, as you said, even from a distance. But they also presented different aspects of his role. First of all, they presented him as a Christian, Roman, or Byzantine, whatever term, man. This was the primary. But then in his public appearances, he was also the head of state, the head of the army, depending on the context, of course, the arbiter of justice, the source of all authority and power and privilege. But he was also the vicar of Christ on earth, the chosen, the divinely chosen ruler, the sun emperor, the source of light, which is beneficial to the subjects but burns the enemies. All these different aspects were part of the public image of the emperor. Not so much his personality, his individuality was kind of suppressed, but it was actually the basis on which this public image was built. So it was present, but not promoted. So I wanted to say he was clearly an image of authority and power, and with a sacral aura. All these were part of the emperor's public appearances. And as I said, depending on context, different aspects were highlighted, and dress, as you mentioned, had really a central role in bringing different aspects of the emperor's image to the fore.
Can you give us some examples about how those attributes of the imperial position were reflected in the dress? So the gender aspect is probably clearest, that he's dressed like an elite, you know, man. But what about all of the others that you mentioned? I mean, just one or two examples of like what kind, how would you look at this image and say, ah, that is a Christian, Roman, justice, son, you know, wealth, whatever.
Well, all these aspects could be present in, but as I said, some of them came to the fore. For example, when he appeared as the head of state in promotions of dignitaries, he would wear a similar kind of dress to the dignitaries. It was the same type of dress, though his dress was much more elaborate, with use of rare materials that were exclusive to the emperor, like purple silks and pearls and precious stones. So that made him appear as part of the hierarchy, at the top of the hierarchy, but still part of it because of the sharing of the same dress.
Right.
When we have him, for example, as the representative of Christ on earth, he's usually presented in the most famous and familiar dress that we know, the one that is preferred for his representation in Byzantine art, which is characterized by the loros, which is a long bejeweled scarf that is wrapped around his torso. And also because he can hold a cross, the symbol of the cross, and his crown also has a cross at the top often. So that also brings out his Christian faith and his role also as the defender of the faith. So this kind of element that the Byzantines or East Romans or were sensitive to this, they would recognize it and appreciate the symbolism.
Yeah, I like the first point that you made, that the way in which other people were dressed around the emperor also signaled those particular role that he was playing in that context. So it's not just the emperor in isolation also, or the general context, but also what other people are wearing. Is he surrounded by clergy? Is he surrounded by other dignitaries, by soldiers? So there were modulations in all of this. But one thing seems to be relatively constant, which is that these emperors are overdressed, right? Compared to, so ancient Roman emperors would sometimes in some context present themselves as naked. Mm-hmm. So what did this signify? Why aren't the later emperors shown this way? When did that tradition stop?
Well, that tradition basically stops with Constantine, which means it didn't even start. Constantine is at the end. We have the one secure statue of Constantine where he's semi-nude, because the lower part of his torso is covered with a mantle, is the one in Rome at the Basilica of Maxentius.
Yes.
And it has to do, I think, with two aspects of the Roman emperor, the hero, because nudity is associated with heroes, and also perhaps with gods, because some of the gods of the pagan pantheon were represented, not always, but in some representations, again, semi-nude. So for an increasingly Christian empire, these associations of, you know, the earlier Roman imperial statuary, as well as Christian beliefs about nudity and modesty, which applied to both men and women. It wasn't just women who needed
Right.
to cover up. I think they impacted this tradition, and it died out only until the 6th century, when we have an emperor represented in military dress. His arms are covered, but you can still see his legs under the skirt of the body armor.
Right.
The legs, I mean, in the famous Barberini ivory, which is in the Louvre, if you see the emperor on horseback, his legs are naked. His arms are now covered, but his legs are naked.
Right.
After the 6th century, even that disappears. And when we have emperors in military dress, which is very rare, in the Middle Byzantine period, they wear trousers. So nothing is actually visible of the body, apart from the head and the hands. So it's, you know.
Yeah. So this is one of the areas where, you know, Christian values shaped imperial representation in a pretty strong way. And I'm reminded of an episode in the life of Severus of Antioch. This is the Bishop of Antioch. He died in the early 6th century, who was one of the leaders of the Anti-Chalcedonian Church. And he was old and ill, and I think the doctors advised that he take a bath, but he was completely unwilling to take his clothes off to take the bath. He said he had not seen himself naked in decades.
Yeah.
And they had to like cut the clothes off of his body. It was, yeah. And you can see that this is a strong sort of, you know, with some people, it's pretty strong social value.
But also, it's important to remember that nakedness was not only shameful, but was also a sign of vulnerability. When it lost its association with the hero, it was kind of a sign of vulnerability, apart from. So in the image of the emperor, especially as I said, as we move forward and he's not in military dress, nakedness, nudity really didn't have a role to play. And that's why, I mean, in descriptions of defeated enemies, when they walk barefoot or you can see their legs, this is part of their humiliation because they are defeated and vulnerable.
Right.
But while the emperor, you know, this has nothing to, no place in his public image.
I'm actually taking notes here. So you're reminding me of something that I should have thought of earlier for a completely separate project, but you're entirely right. Nudity as vulnerability and as loss of power or lack of power.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the kind of standard imperial garment that we see, especially in the manuscript miniatures, which is a very colorful kind of robe, and it has, you know, various other sort of associated garments. Did emperors dress that way most of the time or for certain special occasions?
No way. That's the garment we talked about, I mentioned earlier, which is the loros, worn over this long tunic with the long sleeves and all that. They actually, at least in the Middle Byzantine period where we have the sources, they just wore it twice a year. On Easter Sunday and on Pentecost. It had triumphal connotations because it also acquired a mystical symbolism. At least this is attested in the 10th century because it was as it remind the way it was wound around the torso. It was reminiscent of the winding sheet of Christ, the burial. And then the gold was reminiscent of the brilliance of the resurrection. So this garment was deemed appropriate for the emperor as the representative, the chosen ruler of Christ on earth. And that's why it became so popular in art, especially in scenes where Christ is shown placing the crown on the head of the emperor. In reality, this was not the garment that he wore on his coronation. Okay, it had nothing to do with the coronation, but it became so popular that we, you know, when we think of the Byzantine emperor, we think of him dressed in this garment, which is called, as I said, the lotus.
Right.
And the only, I'm sorry, the only exception to that was when an ambassador, an important guest, a foreign guest arrived, they could wear the lotus to impress. So even though the garment had a mystical symbolism, Byzantine diplomacy could put it to practical use when they wanted to awe an important visitor. So that perhaps is one of the ways it became so dominant in the visual representation of the emperor.
Right, and I imagine that in other contexts, emperors had a range of formal clothing to wear. Mm. Though, you know, at the back of my mind, so there's this thought that's always nagging at me, which is when I ask myself, what did emperors wear most of the time? The answer would be whatever they wanted. And there's some emperors, for example, Justinian or Basil II, who I imagine most of the time would probably be the shabbiest dress, the least well-dressed people in the room, but expect other people to be well-dressed. Like, I don't know. I think that's a sign of power too, but whatever. So these garments they cover the entire body. They seem to be rather restrictive. So in those contexts that you have studied, how did emperors use body language to express themselves? Or did they not? Like this ideal of just being still in those contexts was supreme.
Well, the idea of stillness is conveyed primarily by the art. But if you look at the text, emperors are often on the move in procession. So they are moving. They are moving slowly and stately, especially because of the garments and the weight of the garments and because they needed to be careful. In general, sudden movements and violent movements needed to be avoided because an emperor needs to have self-control. So we know from the text that there were occasions where you have the emperor is still and silent. And then there is a contrast. Many ceremonies are built on this contrast between stillness and movement. But when they move, again, the gestures are orchestrated in a way. They will light candles in specific sanctuaries. They would, you know, often offer adoration to Christ and when entering the church. They would make some gestures to convey insignia, or they would bless the people in certain audiences. So they would make gestures. They were not completely still. And occasionally there were occasions when they would actually talk as well, not just gesture. But as I said, these were prescribed gestures. We are talking about ceremonial rituals. They were prescribed gestures, and they were all always, you know, slow and stately to maintain the aura of the emperor, the sacral aura, and this kind of approach. But no, they were not completely still.
Right.
And also, we have some references where it is claimed that they could convey their mood with their eyes. The gaze was important. And perhaps when they wanted to convey praise, a slight smile, but no laughing, but a smile would give encouragement to some. And, you know, so I think art presents this kind of very iconic, still austere, but I think it was much more lively. Not a what's the word, a gradius, but
Right, right.
there was activity. The gaze was appears to have been quite important.
I had the sense that there was, for formal occasions and ceremonies, a kind of whole language of gestures and signs and just very subtle facial expressions and nods and so forth that was understood, especially by the court attendants, that emperors could. Yeah, like the Queen of England today, like there are all these very subtle hand signals that, no, not today, but anyway, when we when Elizabeth reigned, I learned about all the ways in which she would move the purse and touch the purse in a certain way, which conveyed to certain people. Anyway, and so queen watchers are like very attuned to these kinds of subtle hand signals. But you also read accounts of like parties in the palace. Like non-formal occasions, right, where the emperors are laughing and drinking, and it's like very boisterous. Yeah, but
And you read about emperors who like to play practical jokes, and it's
yeah,
like,
yes.
but in the formal public image of the emperor, this kind of behavior had no
Right.
place. The emperor needed to maintain this mystique, but also it's not just the emperor. Even in the Roman Byzantine construction of the man, this kind of violent movements and, laughing out loud or crying or the intense expression of emotion was frowned upon
Yeah.
because it was considered a feature of the woman, not the man. So even more for the emperor, he had to be very careful.
Very, yeah. And what about on military campaign? And I'm referring to emperors who did go on campaign and who were militarily active themselves. So emperors who were generals, like, let's say on a day of battle. Not when sometimes they spend months in tents or camps or whatever, but just like on a day of battle, what would emperors be wearing? Was there a separate military outfit? Or if not, if they were just wearing armor that, similar to everyone else, though perhaps higher quality or more, how would you pick an emperor out from a distance?
Well, if they were planning to fight, their armor needed to be real armor because it needed to be practical, protective, real armor. And we actually have some references to emperors wearing, for example, the helmets with the chain mail that even covered the face complete, so you couldn't see the face of the emperor. And so the armor needed to be functional and real. How you could tell the emperor from others? First of all, they could wear a surcoat, a cover over the body armor, which could be adorned with purple or gold. We have a description of such a surcoat worn by Manuel the first, Komnenos. So certain elements of the armor, not the protective ones, but addition to that, could indicate the status. And of course, the emperor, you could tell that it's the emperor because he was surrounded by his bodyguards. And also he had a banner. He there were the imperial banners. So it was important for the emperor to be visible for the morale of his troops if he was taking part in the army. So he had to be distinctive and from afar. So some elements of his dress, but also his retinue and the banners. And we know, for example, again, Manuel, I am referring to Manuel the First because he was the military,
Yes.
let's say, emperor, and he was proud of his achievements in the field, really. So we know that he actually invented an imperial banner, which was very impressive. It was called an octopus because I guess it had eight tongues, and it was it must have been a marvel, because there is at least one poem about this banner and about how the emperor impressed everyone in a display of military prowess. So, of course, he had to be visible, but also protected in the field. And being visible meant he also attracted the enemies. Yeah. So that's why the armor needed to be functional.
Yeah, you have a wonderful description of this banner, also, you know, based on the sources, which seems to have been enormous, and probably designed so that when the emperor was riding, it would flutter and expand in size. And I remember some banners from, I think this is the 4th century, that actually made noise, that they were designed so that when the air passed through them, they would make this loud whistling noise. And anyway, this is a very impressive sort of self-presentation in the field there. So let's turn to another topic, the rituals of the emperor's dressing and undressing. So what did they signify? You know, why were they so elaborate sometimes?
Well, actually, the only time that the emperor was publicly dressed, that you could actually see him put on garments, was his coronation.
Right.
All the other times, you saw him in different dress, even during a ceremony, but you never actually saw him change, because the transformation is, again, has to do with vulnerability. It's kind of a very sensitive. So he would change behind curtains in special rooms, or if there were no rooms, for example, when he went to the different churches in Constantinople, there were special changing rooms for him behind curtains, so he would appear transformed. And this was part of the kind of miraculous and impressive aspect of the emperor. When there were no rooms, his eunuchs will stand around him in a circle and protect him from, you know, the gaze of potentially, you know, threatening individuals. And not everyone could touch. There were very few people who could actually touch the emperor and help him change. If you inadvertently touched the emperor or stepped on his dress, this was bad. This is what happened with Michael II before he became, you know, Michael II, when he was the groom of Leo V. He inadvertently stepped on his garment, on Leo's garment, and even the emperor thought, ah, this might indicate something not, you know, potentially dangerous. And of course, he was proven right. You couldn't really touch the emperor without his permission. Only much later in the 14th century, as part of a ceremony, if an official saw, this was the official in charge of the imperial wardrobe, if he noticed that the emperor was behind the curtains, and before the curtains opened, if this official noticed that there was some mud on the emperor's dress or an insect, you know, he was given permission to take, he could take off his hand and then remove the mud or the insect without asking.
Right.
It was the only time, but otherwise you couldn't really touch the emperor, because only the servants in charge of changing the...
Yeah, this tremendous protocol. And I was struck the first time I ever read Psetlov's Chronographia about Michael IV, who had epileptic seizures. And Psetlov says that his attendants would quickly put a curtain around him so no one could see him in that state. But Then later, the more I realized that these curtains must have been on hand all the time. Just any time an emperor might say, "Okay, seclude me now," and because I want to
Yes.
sneeze or whatever. I don't,
Yeah. No, it was part, again, this part of concealment, revelation was part of the imperial ceremonial, and it enhanced again both the mystique but also the sense of privilege of the people who were given the vision of the emperor, often in a different dress from when they saw him, before. So it was all part of this, cultivating the mystique of the imperial office.
So did that mystique attach to the clothes themselves? And I'm thinking in the following sense that, so I've read about monarchies where the ruler would wear a new set of clothes every day and then give them to favorites, or and that was a sign of great favor. But there's some, either, I don't know, garments, but certainly accessories that were worn by more than one emperor in Constantinople. So did they wear their predecessors' clothes? Like, were the clothes themselves regarded as prestigious or establishing a sense of continuity or tradition or antique or relic, quasi relics, or something like that? Did emperors give away their clothes to favorites? How did that work with the clothes themselves?
Well, they certainly did wear their predecessors' clothes. We have an interesting testimony by Liutprand when he went to, this is a Western emissary, to Constantinople in the 10th century, when the emperor was Nicephorus II. And he talks about attending a procession and how faded and smelly the garments were, and that they were made for taller emperors than Nicephorus. So he's making fun of this, while I imagine that Nicephorus felt that he was displaying the venerability of the Roman office, and especially in when you had a Western ambassador in attendance with their own representing an authority with its own imperial aspirations. Nicephorus was making a point that we are the original ones and we have the garments and the insignia to prove it. It didn't work on Liutprand. And we know that they were kept in the imperial wardrobe. We know of emperors restoring the garments, like Theophilus in the 9th century. So they were there, they were kept, they were maintained. Symbolic, I don't, apart from this kind of their importance and their venerability, I don't know. We hear some of the crowns, which were also kept in Hagia Sophia, being associated with important figures of the past, but not necessarily the other garments. I mean, we don't have anything in Byzantium like the crown jewels you have in where it's a specific set of objects that they come out every time. We don't have that in Byzantium, but still they would not give, wear a different dress every day. These were extremely expensive. But occasionally, the emperor could give a garment to a favorite office holder or dignitary. We have an example from the 12th century of Alexios Komnenos giving a garment to one of his generals, who, of course, doesn't put it on. They were not for putting them on. He donates it to a church because, again, it's he actually, this general, when he speaks about this gift very proudly, he mentions that this had been worn by the emperor on his sacred body, so it was recognized. Much later, in the 14th century, we have another reference to the emperor. It says this reference that when the emperor goes hunting, if for some reason he bloodies his garment. He gives it to the headhunter. His headhunter gets a donation of the garment of the emperor if it's destroyed, basically, by blood. But that's a different kind of mentality, and it's not the same as the donation as a reward. So
yeah, after all, I mean, imperial garments are very specific to the imperial position, and for someone who's not the emperor to wear them could often just be construed as an act of treason, a plot to seize the throne. And so you would never wear such a thing, though, you know, it's an honor to be given it. It's probably much, much safer to donate it to a church or a monastery to also indicate your piety and so forth. But I would never, that would be one of the most dangerous things to put on. What about hairstyles? What hairstyles were appropriate for emperors?
Well, the hairstyles that were appropriate for men in general in the empire, which meant that they could be short, or if they wanted them longer, not longer than the shoulders. Longer than the shoulder meant, you know, that you were treading dangerous ground because it brought you closer to women. Long hair was associated with women. So longer than the shoulder, that was no. And also, Byzantine emperors could take care of their hair, but again, they shouldn't pay inordinate attention to hair styling, because again, this was, it could provoke criticism about vanity and effeminacy. And of course, after the 7th century, they also had beards.
Ah, yes.
It wasn't just the hair. After the 7th century, regularly, it becomes the norm. Before, not, I mean, we have beardless emperors, but after the 7th century, the emperor needed a beard. No clean-shaven emperor.
Was there room for individuality in the way the emperors dressed? And I mean, do we know of emperors who broke with protocol, even on formal occasions, and were there consequences to this? Have you found any stories?
I haven't actually found anything about breaking protocol in terms of dress. Nothing comes to mind, actually. I mean, the emperors could change the design of some of the garments. They could introduce some fashionable touches. For example, in the 12th century, they could wear pointed shoes, which was the fashion. But breaking protocol, they could be a bit relaxed. Some emperors, we know that they seem to be a bit relaxed about not just their own dress, but dress in the court in general. But I don't really.
Okay.
Nothing comes to mind.
So you've also you've discussed the adoption of turbans in the later period. So among other Eastern styles that became popular at the court. Do we know why this happened? I mean, what were high officials, you know, trying to convey with this?
I'm not sure they were trying to convey something with this. Turbans were part of Byzantine dress for many centuries. We see them in portraits already in the 11th century of officials or provincial potentates. There is written evidence that we had them in Constantinople earlier, maybe as early as the 9th century. It's a peculiar source, is the narration of Saint Sophia. It's a kind of mystical, mythical, fantastical account of the foundation of Hagia Sophia. But in that, Justinian is described as visiting the monument with a kerchief on the head. So, and then Liutprand again talks about the Byzantines wearing kerchiefs rather than hats. So it seems that what you have in the later period is as other types of dress that had been current in male attire also enter the official dress, the turban seems to me to be one of those, you know, it wasn't something new.
Okay.
It was new in the 8th and 9th century, and I imagine because in traditional Roman dress, the men did not wear a head cover.
Right.
Romans did not, unless you were a farmer in the fields, you did not wear a head cover. I imagine contact with the Arabs and seeing how, you know, the headdress was important, perhaps as, you know, a status symbol, or it might have been adopted. And then it became part, and once you adopt it, it loses, and it becomes part of the local dress.
Right.
It loses its
Right.
association or of otherness or foreignness. So,
Exactly.
I think by the 14th century, no one thought that the turban was, you know.
Exactly. And this is one of the most difficult things to convey, you know, especially to students, but I think we find it often in the scholarship where certain cultural traits, attributes, or practices are essentialized and identified with a particular culture and are thereafter treated as if they were foreign. But in reality, when cultures adopt things, you know, after a few generations, but certainly after a few centuries, they're completely naturalized and are not seen as foreign, even if your own, you know, genealogical research or whatever shows them to be that. Everyone's culture, everyone throughout the world, their culture has taken things from foreign cultures and are treated as completely natural and part of the local culture. And we shouldn't do this with things like, you know, turbans or anything else unless our sources flag them that way. So that's anyway.
I agree. Yeah.
So there's so much more we can discuss, but I did want you to leave us with a description of the Proekipsis ceremony.
Okay.
Because it is one of the more spectacular settings where all of these things come together. And I think it really conveys a sense of how the emperors wanted to impress their subjects and foreigners and so on. So can you tell us what that ceremony was?
Okay. The Proekipsis ceremony, we know more about it from a description in the 14th century. It seems though that it's earlier. It's an orchestrated epiphany, very dramatic, theatrical epiphany of the emperor. It's really amazing. It must have been amazing. It takes place on a specifically constructed raised platform, which is called Proekipsis, and that's where the ceremony takes its name after the structure. The structure was constructed in the courtyard of the palace, the imperial palace in Constantinople at Blaherne. And so the ceremony took place on the eve of Christmas, on Christmas Eve, and on Epiphany on the 6th of January. In late afternoon, early evening, because light was central to this. So there were curtains. Behind closed curtains, the emperor would ascend on this stage, raised stage. He would be dressed at this later date, he would be dressed in his laurels, and he would hold a cross in one hand and the akakia, which was a red pouch in the left hand. So he would stand in the middle. If he had a son, his son would be there with him. There was a balustrade in front of the stage, and it covered, the emperor would be visible down to his knees, so you couldn't see his feet. And then, but the other interesting thing was that right and left, you had two other men who were kneeling down, but one of them was holding the imperial candle holder with a lit candle. And the other one, the imperial sword, but they would be kneeling down. So you can imagine these two objects hovering on either side of the emperor. So when everyone was in position and in front of the stage, you would have the members of the court, you would have representatives of the army, you would also have people walking in, the people of Constantinople coming in the courtyard. That's why it was in the courtyard. And then opposite the stage, you would have imperial banners. It was kind of, grand production. There were singers and musicians with musical instruments. And there was also some mechanism of lighting the stage. And then, when everything was in place, the signal was given, the curtains would be drawn apart, the light would come on, and then the singers would start singing and the instruments would start playing. And it was just like you had this epiphany, this of the emperor. And you can imagine, surrounding darkness, brightly lit stage with the emperor in gold and purple and, everything. So this was the kind of presentation of the emperor as the, as we said, the sun emperor, but also the vicar of Christ on earth, because of course on Christmas you had the birth of the son of justice, righteousness, and his representative was all illuminated there. It was really, it must have been fantastic.
Yes.
And the fact that you could only see him from the knees up, it was like he was indeed rising,
Right.
because he was kind of not touching. You couldn't see him touch earth in a way.
Yes,
So
yes.
it was a Byzantine
It was a
spectacular kind
spectacle,
of.
yes. And I mean, I'm reminded, and most people know the description in Luitprand, the Western ambassador you mentioned earlier, who describes the throne of Constantine the Seventh that rose up toward the ceiling through these mechanical means while everyone was prostrate before him. I mean, I'm really, really fascinated by the choreography of the court. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to thank you too, because you've made it so much more possible for me and others to try to imagine what it was like, because this world is very opaque in many ways. Our histories don't talk about this in quite, they don't explain all of these things. Most of these people knew this, the symbolics already. And you have not only made it possible for me and others to imagine this, but also to explain the all the symbolism and the rituals and the cultural values that are being communicated here. So, again, thank you for all of the work that you've done on this, and you really brought it to life.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a real pleasure to share all this with you. Thank you.
No, it's my pleasure, and I really look forward to more of your work, and we can find another topic in the future, or maybe around some other spectacular ceremonies.
It would be my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. Take care.